message here from JP Morgan is that Bitcoin is way too big to ignore. JP Morgan, again, which is the world's largest globally systemic bank, has now adopted the Saylor playbook. Like, not only has Jamie Dimon now said that Bitcoin is digital gold, but also his bank is offering a structured note using IBIT.
Saylor's come out and said that's going to be the biggest development he sees in 26.
Michael Saylor went up on stage and he said something that I think everybody should hear, and it's that a lot of major US banks and financial institutions have approached him about creating Bitcoin products. That's huge, right? Remember, Saylor's sitting on 660,000 plus Bitcoin. And it shows that JP Morgan has bent the knee, if you will. Vanguard has bent the knee by offering Bitcoin to their clients. And now Bank of America has bent the knee. It's definitely an admission that they're wrong. If Bitcoin manages to soak up just 1% of the global bond market, then Bitcoin would be about $159,000. At a 3% penetration, so 3% of the global bond market, I'm not even talking about the global money markets here, the global equities market, or the real estate market for that matter. I'm just talking about the bond market, which Saylor is really hitting on quite aggressively. At 3%, you're talking about like $500,000 per coin, and at 7%, you're talking about well over $1 million per Bitcoin. I think $1.2 million per BTC. And so you have these the largest banks and financial institutions in the country going from avowed Bitcoin detractors to Bitcoin respecters, if you will, people who like the orange coin, and they want to offer it to their clients, right?
What's up, guys? 70,000 of you guys keep coming back every single month, but 71% are not subscribed. So you're going to miss out on some of the great green candle content. So make sure that you're hitting that subscribe button with the bell notification so you get notified every time I drop a video. All right, now let's get back into this great interview. Bing bong, I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, Joe Consorti in the house. But Joe, I've been seeing you talk a lot recently about the banks coming in with Vanguard, JP Morgan, seemingly the biggest backflips we've seen in Bitcoin up until this time. So tell me, what do you think of all of these banks now starting to come in and TradFi starting to wake up to Bitcoin?
Yeah, so it's a hugely positive development. Thank you so much for having me on, by the way. You have a great show, and we've been meaning to do this for a while, so it's great to finally be on here. Look, I mean, JP Morgan, Vanguard, Bank of America, like these financial institutions and banks finally coming around to Bitcoin. It's no surprise, but really these are some of the major developments, the biggest developments that Bitcoin has had in years, if not decades, right? Notably, Vanguard has been a huge detractor of Bitcoin forever. Its prior CEO said that as long as I'm at Vanguard, we won't have any Bitcoin products. We won't offer any Bitcoin products. And lo and behold, he's no longer the CEO, and they're offering a Bitcoin ETF, a suite of Bitcoin ETFs, rather, to their clients. Notably, they're the world's second largest asset manager, so that's a huge development. JP Morgan has offered is offering a Bitcoin structured note. So is Morgan Stanley, by the way, which is major. That opens up Bitcoin access to a huge cohort of folks who didn't have access to it previously. And Bank of America has advised has opened up the floodgate for its wealth managers to begin advising Bitcoin to their clients, which previously they were not allowed to actively do. If a client came to them and said that they wanted to invest in Bitcoin, the wealth manager was allowed to talk to them about it, but they couldn't actively pitch it to their clients. And now they can with a suggested 1-3% allocation. So that's basically the high level update here. And the message is that Bitcoin is finally coming into the fold with the major banks in the United States and globally, but obviously the US being the leader. And that's huge news, right? I tend to think that the primary way in which people interact with Bitcoin, this has been proven out by the ETFs and how successful they have been since they launched, will be through their banks or their financial institutions, whether it's through their checking account or, you know, sometime next year or the year after that. People can go into the bank and purchase Bitcoin the same way that they could purchase a CD or move money into a high yield savings account, or, you know, through their 401k or their pension plan or whatever, in whatever brokerage they have that at. So it's really just this evolution of Bitcoin playing out in real time. It's massively bullish, right? These are huge pools of capital we're talking about. Bank of America, one of the largest banks in the US, Vanguard, the second largest institutional asset or the second largest asset manager in the world, JP Morgan obviously being the largest, most globally systemic important bank in the US. So yeah, a bit of a ramble there, but those are the major developments on my mind, and all of them are extremely bullish.
Yeah, and I'm curious what you think of now the banks starting to come in and potentially custody Bitcoin and work towards that, because I mean, Saylor's come out and said that's going to be the biggest development he foresees in 26. You know, outside of, you know, obviously, you know, being a proponent of self-custody, and I think, you know, being your own bank is one of the true powers of Bitcoin, but it seems like, you know, a lot of, I guess, people in general would really appreciate having somebody, I guess, hold their hand through it and maybe potentially custody for them. So how big of a development do you just see, like, banks not only like recommending it for asset managers, but the custody aspect of it, I think, is kind of unique here. So how do you see that, I guess, unlocking to potentially, you know, I guess, trillions of dollars at this point?
Yeah, it's interesting. Michael Saylor went up on stage at Bitcoin MENA yesterday, and he said something that I think everybody should hear, and it's that a lot of major U.S. banks and financial institutions have approached him about creating Bitcoin products. That's huge, right? Remember, Saylor's sitting on 660,000 plus Bitcoin at the time of this recording. And so, you know, I tend to think that the primary way in which people engage with Bitcoin will be through their bank, because think about it, right? Self-custody in and of itself is already a huge sell on top of, it's a massively effortful thing that people have to learn how to do on top of something that's already so niche and relatively difficult to grasp, which is Bitcoin. And so if you bring somebody around to the idea of Bitcoin and then you tell them about, you know, needing to custody it on their own, that's a bridge too far for most people. The reality is that most people are comfortable with Bitcoin as an asset, as one asset that exists within their portfolio. Again, that's been proven out by the success of the ETFs, but they're not comfortable self-custodying it, right? I'm a self-custody advocate, but I believe that it's a step in your journey toward Bitcoin. I don't believe that it is a be-all end-all, right? I'm not necessarily a purist. I think that the ETFs are a net positive for Bitcoin. They drive adoption. These are issued by highly regulated financial institutions. The likelihood of that Bitcoin not actually being there is extremely low, if not zero. So it's not something I necessarily worry about. If anything, the ETFs have been massive for driving adoption. And so I think that all that is to say, I do believe that banks will begin offering Bitcoin financial products at some stage next year, whether that's custodying spot Bitcoin at their at the bank itself, whether that's being able to potentially borrow against your Bitcoin at a bank. I think we're much further further away from that. But I do believe that most people will interact with Bitcoin at their bank, and it's a huge development. And the fact that Saylor went out on stage at MENA and said that he had gotten calls from a horde of US banks asking him about this tells us that we're a lot further along in this than we expect. Also today with the IPO of 21, obviously backed by Cantor Fitzgerald, Tether, you have Paulo Arduino in there, you have Jack Mallers in there. You know, Cantor Fitzgerald, you're one step away from the United States government, right? And so I believe that Bitcoin's integration within the banking system at large has never been closer than it is today. And I think over the next 3 years, as this administration remains in office, we're only going to see more developments on that front. And I believe next year, if not by the end of this presidential term, you're going to see a handful of banks across the United States offering Bitcoin to their clients.
Now, do you think that this is a sign that either, you know, MicroStrategy, what they've been doing, and Michael Saylor are either winning or have won, or, you know, that Bitcoin is winning just in the general term, as seeing, you know, JP Morgan, Vanguard, essentially, you know, kind of go from some of Bitcoin's biggest haters for the past few years to now, you know, flipping it as you described earlier. And then, you know, also JP Morgan potentially releasing some preferred notes and doing, I guess, the strategy at this point. So do you see that as a sign of, I guess, like them admitting that they've been wrong and that Bitcoin's been winning this entire time?
Yeah, no, I think that it's definitely an admission that they're wrong. That JP Morgan, again, which is the world's largest globally systemic bank, has now kind of adopted the Saylor playbook. Like, not only has Jamie Dimon now said that there is merit to Bitcoin, which is a huge shift from what he said a couple of years ago, and he's been saying for several years, which is that Bitcoin is worthless, to now not only saying Bitcoin is digital gold, but also his bank is offering potentially exploring the use of Bitcoin as collateral for one, and then it's just created a structured note using IBIT. Now, granted, this is a very small structured note in terms of its market cap and its initial offering size. So I wouldn't read too much into this and say that, oh, it's going to, you know, siphon away trillions of dollars from the global fixed income market or what have you. However, I do think it's a step in that direction, right? Morgan Stanley also filed for a very similar thing and launched it, I believe, last month or the month prior. JP Morgan filed for this last month. And so the high-level story is that institutions want access to Bitcoin's upside, but they are prohibited for doing it for any number of reasons, namely their mandates away from being able to hold actual spot Bitcoin being a commodity, their mandates to hold fixed income instruments and equity instruments. But the message here from JP Morgan is that Bitcoin is way too big to ignore. And so rather than allowing you to purchase Bitcoin directly through them, iBit obviously figured it through BlackRock, obviously figured out a way to monetize that demand for Bitcoin through the management fee of its ETF. BlackRock has since come out and said that the iBit Bitcoin ETF is the most profitable ETF for them, driving hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. I believe $250 million worth of revenue this year or last year. I can't recall. And so basically, these financial institutions want to monetize this demand for Bitcoin. BlackRock is doing it through the management fees associated with iBit. Now, JP Morgan is doing it by, rather than allowing you to purchase Bitcoin and then, you know, getting a spread from that, creating this this structured note in order to offer it to an entirely different cohort of investors, intermediate your exposure and capture some fees in that spread. So for me, this is a massive development, right? And it shows that JP Morgan has bent the knee, if you will. Vanguard has bent the knee by offering Bitcoin to their clients. And now Bank of America has bent the knee. And so you have these the largest banks and financial institutions in the country going from avowed Bitcoin detractors to Bitcoin respecters, if you will, people who like the orange coin, and they want to offer it to their clients, right? It's something that's too profitable to ignore. And the last thing that I'll say here before we jump to the next question is that, you know, ultimately people come to Bitcoin for different reasons. The banks were never going to come to Bitcoin because, you know, they believed in the ethos of the mission. They were inevitably going to come to Bitcoin because of the fat fees that they could farm by offering Bitcoin products. So while the incentives may be skewed, the outcome is the same, which is that more people have access to Bitcoin than ever before. This pristine savings technology, this absolutely scarce monetary vehicle, and that's a net positive, regardless of how they're holding it or the way that these banks structure these instruments.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I mean, at the end of the day, these banks, they're profit maxis, right? They want to be able to make some money off of it. So it was no doubt that as long as Bitcoin kept winning, that they were going to come into this market. But something that a sailor here said, I believe it was either yesterday or the day before in Abu Dhabi, is he's talked about the fixed income and the bond market, you know, $300 trillion bond market, $145 trillion fixed income market. But he mentioned the $200 trillion credit market is something that, you know, could be next on the list to target. And I mean, just getting a small percentage of these, you know, giant pools of capital to move on over to Bitcoin would be absolutely massive. So with the revolution that you're seeing, you know, I guess kind of financial revolution towards the Bitcoin space, what do you make of, you know, Saylor, I guess, targeting these giant pools of capital that essentially have needed some sort of, you know, a modernization of sorts in order to get into the 21st century, to say the very least. What do you take of, you know, these three big giant pools of capital that I just lined out here?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So you have the equity market that Strategy is hitting with its common stock, MSTR. You have the money markets that Strategy is hitting with Stretch, its preferred stock. It's perpetual cumulative variable 9%, I think they're offering now. Paid out monthly, functions very similar to a money market account. That's been massively successful. And then you have them hitting the bond market with Strife, Stride, and Strike, as well as the real estate market to some degree with Strike. And so ultimately, these are huge pools of capital. When we talk about the commodities market in and of itself, you're talking about a market that's sub $30 trillion, probably sub $50 trillion in total, if I'm not mistaken. Very, very tiny, right? Gold in and of itself is, I think, $25 to $30 trillion, something like that. You know, Bitcoin in and of itself is only $2 trillion. And so we talk about Bitcoin reaching gold parity quite often, and we talk about it as this kind of hallowed event. And when it happens, you know, Bitcoin will be about $1.5 million if Bitcoin were to reach gold parity today, assuming gold's current market cap. And we talk about it as some sort of hallowed event. But the reality is that a lot of gold bugs are just going to hold gold. That's assuming that the capital that's going to flow into Bitcoin will come entirely out of gold. And that's not the reality, right? a lot of people crave Bitcoin exposure, but they have mandates that preclude them from being able to hold Bitcoin in a spot fashion. And so Strategy has effectively created these pumps, these capital pumps, in order to bring capital from these different areas of the asset market globally into Bitcoin, right? In some sort of proxy form, in different proxy forms through its preferred equities and its common stock in the ways that I just explained. And so to me, this is quite revolutionary, right? And the price implications for Bitcoin are pretty enormous. If you assume that Bitcoin manages to soak up just 1% of the global bond market, and again, the global bond market being about $318 trillion, then Bitcoin would be about $159,000. And that's just 1% penetration. And that's assuming that the only capital invested in BTC is coming from the bond market, a straight one-to-one translation. Obviously, that's not the way things work, but this lets us gauge the size of what that sort of transfer will look like. At a 3% penetration, so 3% of the global bond market, I'm not even talking about the global money markets here, including credit or the global equities market or the real estate market for that matter, which we're working on at Horizon. I'm just talking about the bond market, which Saylor is really hitting on quite aggressively. At 3%, you're talking about like $500,000 per coin. And at 7%, you're talking about well over $1 million per Bitcoin. I think $1.2 million per BTC. And that's just for one market, right? That's just for the bond market. Not to mention the money market, not to mention the equities market, both of which have different instruments for people to invest in Bitcoin through. Obviously, the equity market, you have the spot Bitcoin ETFs through the money market. You have Stretch. Obviously, of course, Stretch does exist in the equities market. It caters to those who would otherwise buy money market funds, but in a very real sense, it exists in the equities market because it's a preferred stock, but it's targeting that same pool of capital that would be in a money market fund. And you have a whole suite of other instruments that are investing in these other preferred stocks that are more so hitting the bond market. So look, it's a huge revolution. As far as fixed income engineering is concerned, it really is the first step in Bitcoin becoming pristine collateral. You know, the best asset that lenders want to use in order to extend loans against. And it's really just day one in that process. You only have one major player globally that's doing this, and you really have no logical second player on the horizon.
What if I told you you never had to sell your Bitcoin? Instead, you can borrow against it with Salt Lending. Why give up your hard-earned Bitcoin when you can unlock its value without letting it go? With Salt, you get secure Bitcoin collateralized loans with no credit checks, no prepayment fees, and best of all, no rehypothecation. Salt has had zero customer collateral losses since it launched. Salt was the first platform to offer Bitcoin collateralized loans starting way back in 2016. Today, they offer tailored options for both individuals and businesses. And now introducing Salt Shield, the no liquidation solution. No forced liquidations during the lifetime of your loan when you're enrolled with Salt Shield. This just launched at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas, and it is next level peace of mind. For Green Candle listeners only, head to saltlending.com/green-candle for this exclusive offer for your Bitcoin collateralized loan. You can get cash for your Bitcoin today. Salt Lending, secure, trusted, proven.
And it's really just day one in that process. You only have one major player globally that's doing this, and you really have no logical second player on the horizon, or player in second place on the horizon. And I believe that what you're seeing with banks is just them trying to catch up to this reality that there's this insatiable demand for Bitcoin adjacent or Bitcoin backed fixed income, and they're doing their best to catch up.
Now, what do you make of the situation with JP Morgan? Because I think, you know, the way that they've been approaching all of this has been very interesting, to say the very least. I mean, of course, we have Jamie Dimon, who was, you know, just one of Bitcoin's biggest detractors for a while. I mean, I think his comments even date back to maybe a full decade ago of since he started talking about Bitcoin. But now, you know, they're allowing you to borrow against your IBIT Bitcoin ETF. But they also, you know, on the other side of things with MSTR and some of these Bitcoin treasury companies, they've made it difficult. I don't know how closely you're following the increase in the margin supply or the margin for the loans that is required, and, you know, the MSCI ruling and just kind of the hairiness going on around there. But with JP Morgan's new approach with this, do you think that they're losing potentially some market share? And that's why they're essentially, you know, they do have a big moat at this point, but they're playing, I guess, a little bit of these fiat games in order to try to maintain and keep some of their market share by getting these Bitcoin products and trying to incentivize those that they have already in their grasp to utilize their own Bitcoinized products, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, the incentives make sense, right? If you're going to launch effectively products that are sort of aiming at that exact same market as Strategy, you would want to push back on allowing people to easily sell Strategy or buy Strategy or create artificial short pressure on Strategy. So look, it makes sense. I don't think we have enough evidence to conclusively assert that those things are happening. As far as I know, it was just one individual who was unable to sell all of the MicroStrategy that he wanted to sell, or I think he was moving it. I'm not exactly sure. But either way, we just don't have enough data or evidence to be able to conclusively fit those pieces together. So I would say that that's mostly speculation. You know, as far as the MSCI ruling, look, it's like it doesn't make sense to me that you have a company that's creating financial instruments and they're trying to treat it as an investment fund and nothing more. It's not a closed-end trust. It's not someone that's buying and holding Bitcoin and doing nothing with it. It's actively mobilizing the Bitcoin on its balance sheet to transmute its properties into different types of financial vehicles spread across the fixed income market. It has four different preferred stocks in the United States. It has one preferred stock in Europe. It's doing all of these things because of the amount of Bitcoin on its balance sheet. That's why it's able to sell into the market. That's why it's able to issue shares and raise so much money, specifically because of the Bitcoin on its balance sheet, even if the dividends themselves aren't necessarily being paid at this moment in time by selling that Bitcoin. But it's a huge stretch of the imagination to say that, oh, Strategy, because most of its balance sheet is composed of Bitcoin, is an investment trust, because that's not what they're doing. They're mobilizing their balance sheet in order to transmute that digital property into digital credit, as Michael Saylor puts it. So it's completely absurd. It's arbitrary. It doesn't make an ounce of sense. And this is more of a blanket ruling in my mind to mitigate the amount of passive flows that would move into Strategy should they remain in MSCI's indexes. And so I do think that all of this is kind of not necessarily a direct attack on MicroStrategy, but the powers at large are creating conditions where it's unfavorable for MicroStrategy to be included in these indices, which would make it easier to run their business, i.e. Getting a higher market cap, being able to raise more money, being able to purchase more Bitcoin. It seems that they're trying to prevent that from happening. Recently, you've had Strive put out a letter to MSCI to scrap their proposal that would exclude any entity. And this is the rule that we're talking about. It would exclude any entity holding 50% or more of its balance sheet in what's called digital assets, obviously Bitcoin being the main one kind of in that list. And so Strive pushed back against that. The Bitcoin for Corporations company pushed back against that as well. I think it's completely arbitrary. I do think that you see Strategy recently putting in measures to increase its likelihood of inclusion, namely it adding a cash buffer. I think $1.4 billion was the number, a US dollar reserve, if you will. A lot of Bitcoiners will look at that and they won't read the tea leaves. They won't read into that. And they'll say, oh, why isn't Saylor buying Bitcoin using those proceeds? Well, that was an announcement he made last week. And yesterday he just announced another major Bitcoin buy. So that should put all of those fears to rest about Michael Saylor not buying Bitcoin anymore. The reason he did that was to appease the TradFi folks and to increase the likelihood that he would get included in the S&P 500, despite qualifying. Obviously, unfortunately, it is up to a committee that gives the final vote as to whether or not he'll actually be included or any company will be included. And they said no to Strategy. And one of the reasons they said no was, number one, well, actually three reasons they said no. The first being that they wanted proof that Strategy would be able to raise money during Bitcoin downturns. And they proved that yesterday and last week by raising $1.4 billion for its US dollar reserve and then raising enough money as of yesterday to purchase 10,000 more BTC. So they quelled that. And they also wanted to see Strategy have a bigger US dollar reserve, like a reserve of actual US dollar liquidity. And Strategy did that, right? So two of the three major reasons that they were excluded from the S&P 500, or two of the three things that the S&P 500 committee said Strategy should do if they wanted to reevaluate their decision to include them in the index, have been done. right? So these are just measures in order to increase the likelihood that strategy gets included in the S&P 500 and ideally the NASDAQ. Obviously, they're currently included in the NASDAQ. And so, you know, for me, it's a step in the right direction. You have all of these forces that are actively trying to push against strategy's inclusion and other Bitcoin treasury companies' inclusion in these indices. And it just so happens that those same forces, these largest, the largest banks in the United States, are not necessarily the same forces, but the largest, most powerful banks in the United States are on the other side of that, creating different, creating certain instruments, and also making it less desirable, less easy for those who own MicroStrategy to be able to use it on their platform. It's all a really interesting web. I don't necessarily believe a lot of it's connected, but at the very least, the incentives do make sense.
Is it super common to, you know, once you meet the qualifications to get into the S&P 500 on the first go? Because, I mean, Saylor came out in September, was like, hey, I'm not surprised that we didn't make it in the first go around. But, you know, obviously we've got the second go around here in December. They weren't included again. So I'm curious, how common is it? And, you know, how long is it usually before, you know, some of these companies? Obviously, it could be like a case-to-case basis. But, you know, from your experience, do you think that this is something that is, I guess, you know, unique in a sense where they aren't being included in the S&P 500 kind of from the jump?
No, so it's actually not all that common that companies join the S&P 500 immediately once they meet basic criteria. Because as I mentioned, it's this discretionary decision that has to go through the committee. So one of the things that has to be looked at is consistent profitability. Until the accounting rule change earlier this year, Strategy technically was not profitable. They were allowed to book the Bitcoin losses as unrealized loss, or their unrealized losses on their Bitcoin as losses. Those were marked down as losses, but they weren't allowed to book unrealized gains as profits until very recently. And now they're allowed to, obviously, over the last two quarters, they've been allowed to book their unrealized gains as profits, which has been huge for Strategy. That is a that is something that they have going for them in their corner. But it's not all that common that the first time a company qualifies for S&P 500 inclusion, they actually get in. James Seyfarth actually put out a great tweet about this. I don't have it in front of me, but there was a list of like 100 different companies that were up for S&P 500 inclusion. Ultimately, the decision rests with a committee. That committee has its own internal biases. It can create any reason under the sun for not including companies, even if they do qualify. And in the case of Strategy, at this point in time, the zeitgeist is such that it's too risky of a company to include in the indices, despite their insane balance sheet strength, the fact that they hold 660,000 Bitcoin. Doesn't matter to the S&P committee. Ideally, that changes in time. And thankfully, we have a lot of people who are actively working to change the perception over on Wall Street and make it so that Strategy can be included in the S&P 500.
All right. So, I mean, we talked a little bit about, you know, the potential credit, bond, and fixed income markets that Strategy and, you know, Bitcoin in general is going to swallow up. But, you know, outside of that, it seems not only the banks, it's starting to attract a lot of these sovereign wealth funds. You know, so Saylor's been spotted with, you know, the Saudi Arabians, you know, potentially talking to their sovereign wealth funds. Larry Fink's mentioned that he's talking to sovereign wealth funds as well. So, you know, with these giant pools of capital coming in, one, like, is it bullish or is there potentially a bearish argument of the centralization, so to speak, of coins? And then two, with these big giant pools of capital, there's always been the narrative of, you know, diminishing returns over time. So do you think that this is actually a possibility of the diminishing returns, or is this pool, are these pools of capital so big that that's just a moot point and we'll see Bitcoin reach Valhalla at one of these days?
Well, it's a little bit of both, right? Ultimately, it's much harder to move a $2 trillion asset than it is to move a $50 billion asset, right? When Bitcoin was, you know, sort of like a micro cap stock, when it was 30 times smaller than it is today, when it was $3,000, you know, you were looking at an asset that wasn't even hundreds of billions of dollars in size. It was tens of billions of dollars in size. And so all you needed to move the needle was very little. And now that's no longer the case, right? You need quite a lot of capital in order to move Bitcoin by the exact same percentage point that it would have taken much less capital to move, you know, in years prior. And so these are, that part is somewhat true, right? That you will have diminishing marginal returns. However, you also have to juxtapose that with Bitcoin's absolute scarcity, right? The float of this thing will never increase beyond 21 million. We now have 95% of the terminal circulating supply out in circulation. 19.95 million coins, I believe, have been issued. And the remaining, however many, the remaining, you know, 1 million and some change will be mined over the next 115 years, right? So you do have Bitcoin's absolute scarcity, but that is juxtaposed with the fact that it is a much larger asset now. So that is a reality. However, at the same time, right, you got to talk about the size of these sovereign wealth funds that you mentioned and the amount of money that they just have sitting there. So Abu Dhabi, right, one of the largest sovereign wealth funds globally. It's interesting. Last year, I was at Bitcoin MENA and they announced that they were purchasing Bitcoin. While I was up on stage, and that was interesting. So I got to react to that in real time. But they hold a bunch of IBIT. I believe as of their most recent filings, they hold, I think, 16 million shares or 17 million shares. And it tripled its stake earlier this year. The sovereign wealth fund manager in Abu Dhabi has said that it's very similar to gold. You also have Luxembourg. They have about 1% of their portfolio in Bitcoin ETFs. You have the Kingdom of Bhutan, obviously notoriously holding, I think, over 13,000 Bitcoin. It's a very, you know, the Kingdom of Bhutan, set that aside, it's not necessarily a large systemically important country or a story that will move the needle as far as Bitcoin is concerned. But more recently, you also have Norway with their global pension fund purchasing Bitcoin, I believe through indirect exposure like MicroStrategy, but either way, I think an equivalent of like 7,000 or 8,000 BTC. So it's a story that's been happening more often over these last couple of years, sovereign wealth funds purchasing Bitcoin. And it's no surprise that it's happening with higher frequency, right? They experience the exact same problem that you and I experience, Brandon, which is perpetual fiat debasement. And as capital allocators, it's their job to make sure that they're hedging themselves against that the most effectively, as effectively as they can. And so it's no surprise that you see these major players allocating to Bitcoin in size, because they feel the exact same problem that you and I feel, albeit they might not feel it as acutely. But as capital allocators, they want to front run this thing. They want to get out in front of it and they want to allocate to it. And so it's no surprise that we're seeing it. Look, when we're talking about sovereign wealth funds, we're talking about entities with tens of billions, if not hundreds of billions of dollars, if we're talking about the largest sovereign wealth funds in purchasing power. And so even a small percentage allocation to Bitcoin really moves the needle as far as price is concerned. And you also have to remember that these are entities that don't usually sell things very quickly. They're not high frequency traders, they're buying and holding. And that, I know this is not what we're talking about, but it also plays into the Bitcoin ETFs and that cohort of holders, because they as well are buyers and holders of Bitcoin. They don't purchase Bitcoin and then sell it rapidly. They're not traders. They're not looking for a quick 100x. They're buying and holding for the long term. And the reason that we know this is on this major drawdown where Bitcoin fell 34%, the ETF AUM, the assets under management within the spot Bitcoin ETFs, only fell by 5%. And so Bitcoin's price fell by 6 times more, actually almost 7 times more, than the AUM and the Bitcoin ETFs fell. And so that tells you that the ETF holders were holding tight while the spot Bitcoin holders were panicking and selling. The exact same dynamic, albeit to a lesser degree, is the exact same with these sovereign wealth funds. They're purchasing these things for years, if not decades. And so while we do see diminishing marginal returns in Bitcoin in terms of the amount of capital that's required to move Bitcoin by the same percentage as years prior, these are entities that are going to be holding Bitcoin for the long run, and they're not going to be selling it. And that's a massively bullish development. That's what I have to say as far as sovereign wealth funds are concerned. Reading new news about that every single week, that makes me more bullish than anything that could happen to Bitcoin's price.
Wow. All right. There we go. I like it. And I mean, I agree with you, right? These players that are coming in are very different, to say the very least, right? I mean, they're, like you said, they're buying and holding. Last bull run, we had exchanges blow up. You saw FTX, Celsius, BlockFi, you name it. But the true power of Bitcoin is getting it off an exchange into cold storage. This bull run, I'm trusting Trezor, the company that's been around for over a decade, and they just had a brand new release of the best hardware wallet in the game, the Trezor Safe 7. It's got the first audible secure element. No other hardware wallet has this. On top of it, I travel a lot, so I need an easy way to connect my Bitcoin hardware wallet to my laptop, phone, what have you. Therefore, it is the easiest way and has the best connectivity to access your Bitcoin. This is truly how you become your own bank. And the best way to do that is with a Trezor Safe 7. So you could go to the affiliate link down below and get yourself one right now, and do it quickly because they are flying off the shelves, folks. So do it with the easiest and best way to get your Bitcoin off exchanges. So go to the affiliate link down below, get yourself a Trezor Safe 7, and get your Bitcoin off exchanges in the easiest way possible. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show. All right, there we go. I like it. And I mean, I agree with you, right? These players that are coming in are very different, to say the very least, right? I mean, they're, like you said, they're buying and holding. So do you think, I mean, outside of the potential diminishing returns, just because it is a larger asset, I'm kind of the belief that it might be diminished to the downside, but because of Bitcoin's fixed supply, we don't really have an asset like this. Of course, you can maybe compare it to gold, but for some reason, they always find more gold that is unmined or something like that, and more gold just magically appears. So because Bitcoin has that true finality and that true scarcity, do you think that there is that potential where, you know, we start to see maybe a supply shock or a short squeeze of sorts? Because, you know, I mean, if you look at the numbers, there's just over 2 million left on exchanges. I think last I saw there was maybe 150,000 left on OTC desks. I mean, we got Sailor and these treasury companies buying up over the year supply in nearly just a quarter. So, from all the Bitcoin miners. So, I mean, I think at the end of the day, it's just math. But do you foresee this potentially happening where, we could get something, better to the upside just because of the type of buyers that we're having coming in?
Yeah, there's potential for it. I mean, ultimately, what dominates the US stock market today more than ever is passive flows, right? People who are passively allocating to their 401k or their pension or their Roth, whatever, every single 2 weeks, or pensions allocating on behalf of the people who are in the pension, allocating just passively every single 2 weeks. That's increasing in its relevancy in the stock market over the last several years. Over this past decade, has been totally dominated by an increasing amount of passive flows. And so, you know, that's a trend that you can't really ignore. And as Bitcoin bubbles to the surface, if you will, in terms of its viability as an asset, in terms of its popularity, you're only going to see more passive flow investing over time. And so, you know, I believe that it's going to make up a larger and larger share of the pie as far as total passive investing is concerned on a dollar for dollar basis. Bitcoin's going to make up more of that, particularly as more young people enter the workforce, as more people that are the age of you and me, Brandon, or even slightly younger than us, entering the workforce, getting their benefits, allocating to their 401k or their IRA or what have you every 2 weeks. They're going to be buying Bitcoin, right? Because there's this recognition among Gen Z, there's this shared sense of financial nihilism or financial optimism. Bitcoin is owned by both people, both cohorts of people, that the only real way to get ahead is get an investment that can outperform the real rate of inflation, which is, 7 to 10% annually. And Bitcoin is the only asset that's proven to do that through time. So I think that Bitcoin will make up even more of those passive flows as a result of who's entering the market now. And I think it's going to make for a much more stable base of Bitcoin going forward. Now, to the question of whether or not these the new folks that are buying could create this material, this outsized impact on Bitcoin, where instead of seeing these diminishing marginal returns over time, and we're observing Bitcoin in log scale, and during the 2012 cycle, during the first halving cycle, we got like 10,000% gains. And so far this cycle, we've seen, a few 100% gains, right? We'll have to wait and see, right? It really all depends on the macro backdrop and where we're headed and how important people view Bitcoin. I tend to think that as it grows larger in size, it's just going to flatten out in terms of its yearly average return profile, just like any other asset. Instead of seeing these crazy, 40, 50, 60, 70% average CAGRs over 3-4 years, you're probably going to see something more modest, right? 20%, 25%, 30%, which is still great if we're talking about a multi-year time frame. And with that, you'll also see a decreased volatility. That's another hallmark of Bitcoin that you'll see as its ownership base shifts from OGs and a lot of people who are in the futures market and trading derivatives and things like that to people who are participating via ETFs or sovereign wealth funds. You're going to see a lot less volatility. Not only because it's less leverage in the system, but because these people aren't actively trading in and out of the asset. You're going to see lower volatility And because of that, you're going to see a more muted return profile, but you're also not going to have the crazy drawdowns, right? It's been a saying that's gone around a little bit over these last couple of months that, you know, Bitcoin didn't have a blow off top this cycle. And so it's reasonable to assume that Bitcoin won't have this extreme crash 80%. It didn't rally 90%, 100% over the course of like 40 days, 50 days. And so chances are it's not going to crash by that amount either. I think that's the MO for Bitcoin going forward. It'll behave much more like a traditional asset. But with that said, I still think it has, you know, this reflexivity to the upside because of its absolute scarcity.
Yeah. And I mean, I hear you on that. And I mean, you know, I always think it just because of the way Bitcoin is, you know, being this scarce asset, it's kind of hard to look at it comparatively, because I don't think we've ever seen it any like an asset like this in our entire lifetimes, or, you know, even people much older than us as well, just because of the uniqueness of this and the, you know, adoption cycle that we're starting to see. So I think it over time, people are going to start to figure this out. But you know, I want to get back to some of the potential Bitcoin products taking over some of these markets. You mentioned the real estate market already, you know, and I want to talk about the, you know, what you guys are seeing with the macro picture right now, because I think, you know, it's very, depending on who you ask, it's either we're very bullish, everything's looking good, or the world is burning. So I'm sure the answer is somewhere in between, but I'd like you to hear your kind of just general macro outlook and, you know, kind of what you're seeing from the housing market as well, if you're following that pretty closely.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, affordability is at a near all-time low. If we're talking about the economy, it really is an unfortunate thing to see, particularly home affordability. If you take a look at home affordability, between record high prices and mortgage rates where they are, it's driven home affordability to an all-time low, unfortunately. And so, you know, obviously mortgage rates are nationwide 6.5%, I believe, right now, which is still extremely high, particularly compared to the near zero rates that we saw just 3 to 4 years ago, right? In 2022, 2021, most homeowners that you'll talk today, they're now in a pair of what they call golden handcuffs. But back then it was them refining into an extremely low rate, right? A lot of people who live near me, my neighbors, they caught the bottom. They caught, you know, 2.1, 2.25, 2.09 is the lowest that I heard. They refied to a 2.09% interest rate. That's a rate that we're never going to see again. And so you have this combination of people who do not want to sell their homes. And because of the massive amount of money that was printed in 2020, home prices are now more elevated than ever before, right? So you have extremely high rates, you have extremely elevated home prices. And because rates are so high relative to the average outstanding mortgage rate, nobody wants to sell. And so that's the situation that we find ourselves in, unfortunately. And what it's caused is this record low in home affordability. You see more people in Gen Z are saying that they'll never own a home than ever before. And it's really, really devastating. So, you know, the ways to fix this that have been proposed by the administration don't necessarily breed a lot of confidence in me. The first one is they've talked about a 50-year mortgage, which is, of course, renting from the government until you die. If you think about it this way, you know, the money required to pay for a 30-year mortgage may save you on a similarly sized mortgage, you know, $300 to $400 per month, which is pretty huge. That's going to put a lot of people into homes that couldn't previously afford it. But the caveat is that over those first 10 years, you're basically paying off only interest and you're not paying down any of your principal, right? So that's the unfortunate caveat, right? It's selling you this dream of home ownership, but for those first 10, 15 years, you're not actually going to be working toward ownership whatsoever. You're going to be working through your interest. By the time you reach your principal, chances are you'll have already moved out, because the average time that somebody owns a home is 7 years. So we have this home affordability crisis, and we don't have necessarily a lot of great solutions to fix it. And that's kind of where we are. A couple of interesting stats for you. U.S. home equity is at an all-time high, $35.7 trillion. The value of the total U.S. residential real estate market is $55.1 trillion. And so these markets are more overvalued than ever. But at the same time, returns are also disappointing more people than ever before. If you take a look at the Case-Shiller National Average, which is the across 20 cities in the country, the average price of homes. And then from that, we can gauge whether homes are rising or falling or whatever. And this year, when adjusted for inflation, right now, as of the latest numbers, home prices are actually declining 1.72% when you adjust for inflation, which is over 3% again. And so in reality, most homeowners, they're not moving, right? They're sitting on their, you know, they've got their golden handcuffs per se. They're locked in with their low rate. They don't want to sell because then that would mean they have to buy a new home and that would mean getting into a higher rate. But at the same time, it's their home isn't returning them really anything, right? When adjusting for inflation, it's actually declining in value. And so this is a massive problem. And it's a problem not a lot of people talk about because most of the question around housing revolves around new homeowners, right? I'm of the belief that unless we see a massive correction in housing prices, which the Fed will not allow, the Treasury will not allow. We've seen that in 2008. We saw it in 2019, in 2020, in 2022, or excuse me, 2023. They're not going to allow a crash in home prices, which for me would be the single most important thing to actually get young people into homes. They're going to make sure home prices go up forever. And so I'm of the belief that the American dream of homeownership is very much out of reach until they allow that to happen. They can do one of two things. They can allow home prices to crash, which, you know, obviously in doing so, they would have to induce a recession in order for that to happen. Or they could build an insane amount of homes in order to bring prices down, or do both in tandem. That would be the most impactful thing. But those are things I don't believe that they're going to do. And so as far as the solution is concerned, who knows? But going back to existing homeowners, the home tends to be people's largest asset. It makes up 60% of the average American's portfolio. But because of that stat that I just read off to you, which is that homes are actually declining in inflation-adjusted terms, it's actually their worst performing asset, more often than not, unless they're holding cash, right? Cash is their worst performing asset. Their home is their second worst performing asset, but it makes up such a large part of their portfolio. And so the question becomes, and this is why we build Horizon, the question becomes, okay, what can we do here? How can we solve for this problem, right? Record high home equity. It's actually almost doubled in the last 5 years. So prior to 2020, it was $20 trillion. Now it's $35.7 trillion. So it's doubled. This massive pile of money that's just burning in value has doubled. What do we do about this? Well, Horizon, we let people swap their home equity for Bitcoin. So you're moving out of this asset that in inflation-adjusted terms fell by almost 2% to an asset that has risen over the last 5 years, 70% every single year, right? Or over the last 3 years, 70% on average over those last 3 years. So it's really a no-brainer. We've serviced, you know, dozens of homeowners at this point, but we're a solution that exists for existing homeowners, right? As far as new homeowners, I really don't know what can happen other than allowing the housing market to crash, which would induce a recession. But we've seen time and again that the Fed will do whatever they can to avoid a recession. So it remains to be seen. I think there's a massive class of renters who are increasingly gambling and they're doing sports betting and they're going on Polymarket because they can't afford homes. And unfortunately, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. So the onus is on everybody that's listening, if you're a young person, to buy and hold Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's the only, I guess, way out at this point to go and get some various assets. But, you know, especially Bitcoin being one of them. But you mentioned one of Saylor's products here earlier. I can't remember if it was Stretch or Stride or one of those. But, you know, one of the perpetual notes that is essentially tapping into the real estate market. Do you think that, you know, the way that this market is playing out, that the way of real estate investing, so to speak, like owning multiple homes to try to get that cash flow in, do you think that that is, you know, going to end here soon just because of, you know, the craziness we're seeing from these housing prices and that these Bitcoinized products are going to start to tap into that, or we're already starting to see it tap into to some real estate, to the real estate market, excuse me?
Yeah, for sure. So I was talking about Strike, and Strike is interesting because every share of Strike is convertible into 0.1 shares of MicroStrategy. Currently, a share of Strike is priced at $87 or $86.45 on the NASDAQ. And so they get to participate in common equity upside. They also get 8% dividends, and it's payable quarterly. And so very similar to owning a rental property, for example, you have the option to sell it to participate in the upside of that property's appreciation. But you're also receiving X amount of dollars every month in order to cover your expenses. And therefore, you're taking in this cash flow, but you have the option to sell it in the future, very similar to a rental property. That's the reason that Strike hits on the real estate market so much. But it also is far superior to owning a rental property because guess what? When you own a rental property, chances are you're not clearing 8% a year. And also, it comes with a whole host of liabilities that you have to deal with. It comes with a mortgage payment, of course. And the difference between what your renter is paying and what your mortgage payment is, that's your profit. If you don't have a renter, right, for any number of months, you're high and dry. You have to cover that mortgage payment yourself. And then maybe, depending on how long you don't have a renter for, a couple of months worth of no renter can clear you of an entire year's worth of profit. Okay. So that's thing number one. Thing number two, and this gentleman, Alex, on Twitter, who is a pro MLS soccer player who also used to own a bunch of rental properties, he's talked about this. He has sold his rental properties for Bitcoin specifically because of the maintenance and upkeep that are required in order to have those rental properties running. You know, my generation, the most popular job that people want to go into is actually landlord. More people than ever say that they want to become a landlord, which, of course, a rent seeker is somebody who does nothing or very little in order to get cash. They want to serve, they want to act as a middleman, right? They've been sold this dream of passive income. And the reality is that being a landlord, being someone who owns rental properties, is not passive income. It's a job, right? And so I feel as more people are realizing this, they're looking at Bitcoin, but more specifically, these preferred equities that have a lot of the attributes that real estate has, right? You're getting this cash flow and you also have the option to sell it down the line, but it comes without all of the maintenance and the expenses and all of these other things, having to deal with tenants, having to repair things, having to run after people for a security deposit. You don't have to do any of that with Strike or with any of the other strategy preferred stocks or with owning spot Bitcoin. And so really it's a revolution in the way that people think about real estate investing. I tend to think that you're going to continue to see a lot of people dump their rental properties.
One of my absolute favorite things about Bitcoin is meeting all of you in person. So mark your calendars for February 28th and come down to where I've called home for the past 8 years, Tampa, Florida. The Bitcoin Bay Foundation is putting on the Sound Money Soiree. It's the third annual. It's a night of Bitcoin, poker, an open bar, and a silent auction. All support will go to Bitcoin Bay, a nonprofit that is creating a circular economy down in Tampa Bay, Florida. They're doing absolutely great things, and it's the Bitcoin community that I've called home for such a long time, and these guys are absolutely crushing it. So please do anything you can to support. Buy your tickets today. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE to get 10% off your Sound Money Soiree tickets.
So do you know anything about Bitcoin?
No.
You guys can come down and see this ugly mug. Come boogie on the dance floor, shake it, and now that Bitcoin's over 100K, you can do it all with your girlfriends. All right, enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
And so really, it's a revolution in the way that people think about real estate investing. I tend to think that you're going to continue to see a lot of people dump their rental properties. A lot of markets in particular, Kissimmee, Florida, next to Orlando, which is, you know, this hot spot for American tourism. A lot of Airbnbs are hitting the market down there. You can get a really cheap home if you want to right now, because a lot of the people who were sold on this idea of I'm going to be a landlord, I'm going to have an Airbnb, they're now realizing that, okay, this is very prone to, I'm very vulnerable if we see a decline in tourism, and it's hard to compete when there are thousands of other people who are doing the same thing as me. They're dumping their properties. You're seeing the same thing around Houston, Texas, the general Austin, Texas area, or Dallas-Fort Worth area, excuse me. A lot of these markets now, a lot of people are coming around to the idea that a landlord isn't passive income, it's an actual job. So they're selling it, they're buying Bitcoin instead, and you know, for me, it's just this digital transformation and talking about strategy here and their different preferred equities. It's a digital transformation of physical capital, right? And so it's taking those properties of Bitcoin that we know and love, this extremely high compound annual growth rate, and it's transmuting those properties into a preferred stock that may be desirable to someone who is looking to invest in fixed income or a real estate investor, right? In the same way that a lot of real estate investors are turning to Bitcoin mining because they want that income, but they also want the optionality to sell the miner in the future. In a way, strategy offers the exact same thing, but could be even more desirable, right? Because you have to factor in Bitcoin miner depreciation. Whereas with Strike and with these other preferred instruments, their issuance relies on revolving around a certain strike price. And so ideally, when you sell it, it'll be very close to the strike price that you had. You don't necessarily have to worry about depreciation. So arguably, it is superior to Bitcoin mining in that front. And very long-winded answer, but you can see very clearly that these Bitcoin adjacent products are much more desirable than owning real estate outright. And so you're starting to see this trend anecdotally, but I believe it's going to be something that continues of folks selling their rental properties and buying Bitcoin instead, or buying these strategy preferred instruments instead.
Yeah, will this be something too? I mean, a lot of Bitcoiners talk about the great wealth transfer that's ahead of us, right? I mean, you lined it out about how much equity is in homes right now. And, you know, the boomer generation, I mean, you know, I'm not trying to get grim too quickly here on the podcast, but let's be honest here, right? They've got, you know, only a, you know, maybe a couple decades left on the lifespan here. And because of that, you know, that boomer generation has never had more of a concentration of wealth than any other generation in history. And that's eventually going to get passed on to the millennial generation and below, who have this affinity towards Bitcoin and start to understand it, have this distrust to the system, because we've lived through 2008. We've lived through, you know, the COVID crisis. We've lived through a lot of these different, you know, things that make us distrust the current system just oh so slightly. But, you know, with this transformation of wealth, you know, I guess put your tinfoil hat on me for a little bit here, Joe. What do you see this playing out? Do you see it all shifting towards Bitcoin? Do you see it kind of changing the way people look at wealth and how they're investing in markets, how Bitcoin can change all these different businesses? How do you see this playing out here?
Yeah, I'll take a different approach entirely. I'm of the belief that this great wealth transfer people are talking about isn't actually going to occur. And let me explain. The reason is that the assumption is that, okay, when boomers pass away, they are going to leave to their estate a massive pile of cash. And that pile of cash is going to get invested directly in Bitcoin. Everyone's going to party. A couple of flaws in that assumption. Number one, that boomers will leave their children a massive pile of cash. Survey data actually shows the majority of baby boomers don't plan on leaving anything to their children, or actually the majority says that they plan on leaving very little to their children. And so that's unfortunately flawed assumption number one. And the reason being is that they're taking that cash instead and they're going on these forever cruises, or they're paying for a retirement home, or they're buying a second property. Most baby boomers would like to travel the world more than they would like to help out their children. Of course, this is a general rule. It's just a generality. It's not every case, of course. I don't want to paint baby boomers into a corner. But if we're going by survey data, then that's the unfortunate reality. They're not going to pass down their wealth to their children. That said, The younger generation purchasing Bitcoin at an increasing rate is something to keep an eye on, because at some stage, these younger people are going to understand that the system is not coming to save them, right? And I believe that most folks who are in Bitcoin understand that very acutely. I think those that don't get it will be forced to understand it. That's what I have to say as far as that goes. I don't necessarily believe in this great wealth transfer. I think the amount, and you can correct me if I'm wrong if you have more recent data, but the amount of wealth that baby boomers hold is over 50% of total household wealth. I think it's something like $86 million or trillion, $87 trillion. But that said, I don't necessarily see a lot of that moving down to the younger generations. I just don't. Not to be a doomer here, but I really don't see it given current social trends.
Yeah, I mean, hey, you probably know a little bit more the social trend aspect. I mean, I'm more of the optimist and kind of thinking of it in theory. But I mean, when you line it all out as well, I mean, you know, majority of that wealth is in the home, and with housing where it is. You know, I don't know too many people that would at least be able to move their houses in a sense like relatively quickly, where, you know, that wealth would just all of a sudden unlock. Because, you know, I mean, what I'm observing from the housing market is houses aren't flying off the shelves like they were a few years ago. They're staying on the market, you know, for 3 to 6 to 9 to maybe even a year. And people are lowering prices all over. I mean, at least where I was in Tampa, that was a pretty common occurrence. Where these houses just weren't moving very quickly. And, you know, with the current macro environment, it seems like it's going to, I guess, we'll see how it plays out, you know, based on the situations that you lined out here earlier. But I want to jump back into the macro with the job Jerome Powell's doing. We're recording this on the 9th. So I believe that he's going to, I mean, all signs are pointing to him cutting interest rates here in the next week or so. So with the, or within this week, actually. So, you know, with that, with inflation still running around 3%, at least for what they're reporting, this will be, I think, the first time I want to say in like 30 or 50 years. I don't know. I get my odd numbers mixed up sometimes here, especially towards the end of this podcast. But it's the first time in a while that they're cutting interest rates when we have it above, or when we have the inflation rate above that 2% target. So with all that being said, you know, how do you see the potential of cutting interest rates affect, you know, the global macro environment? Do you see this potentially keeping inflation running hot, or do you think that that narrative is somewhat overblown?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Fed isn't cutting rates right now because of inflation. They're cutting rates as a result of the labor market. And so there is a risk that it impacts inflation, but ultimately, think about it this way. If people don't have a job, right? If people are thrown out of work, right? Total job openings, the JOLTS job openings has been flat since 2021. Typically, as the economy grows, you'd expect more job openings crop up. But unfortunately, there was this massive drop off in 2020, obviously. I'll actually share my screen here so you can see what I'm talking about. So this is the JOLTS job openings, and I have a couple of other charts here to show. You can see here that total job openings have hovered between 7 and 8 million jobs since 2021. Now, typically, if I'm going back here, you can see that they actually rise over time, or at least they're supposed to rise. It's very interesting. With the business cycle, obviously, it ebbs and flows. It expands and it contracts. You can see here, this kind of lines up with the natural ebb and flow of the business cycle. You had the years leading up into the dot-com bubble, and then obviously the dot-com bubble burst, job openings fell. You have low interest rates leading into the housing bubble, and then obviously the great financial crisis hits, job openings fall. Throughout the 2010s, job openings rise. We largely avert recession. 2019, it gets a little bit hairy as there's a cash shortage in the repo market. COVID hits, boom, we're in recession. Job openings fall. Massive expansion. Job openings explode. But for the last couple of years, job openings have been mostly flat. It's really, really odd. And so all that is to say, the reason Powell is cutting now is because of a labor market that is just on standstill. It is at an absolute standstill. In fact, unemployment is only rising. So you take a look here. This is on a quarterly basis. This is as of September, which is the most recent data that we have. Unemployment has moved up from the cycle bottom in June of 2023 of 3.5%, 3.53% to 4.3%. Now, I'll overlay recessions here because this isn't necessarily something to be worried about just yet. If you take a look here, this is typically where you see recession when the unemployment rate is much higher than it is now. In fact, this cycle, we had a secular low in the unemployment rate that we haven't seen since the late 60s. But regardless, you can see that every single time it rises off that cycle bottom by about less than 100 points. In that case, it was 30 points. In this case, it was 50 points. In this case, it was 37 points, right? So we already have risen materially off the bottom. At the exact same time, you're seeing a labor market on standstill. These are JOLTS job openings. And so to me, this is exactly what Powell should be doing. If anything, he should be cutting by 50 basis points. The unfortunate reality is that despite having rates as elevated as they were not able to get CPI inflation down below 3%. If I overlay the Fed funds target rate on this. Do I have it on this chart? No, I don't. If I overlay the Fed funds target rate on this, you can see that even though rates were elevated at 5.5%, the entire time rates were at 5.5%, inflation only went from 3% to about 2.5%. So it did manage to fall, but that was only after we started seeing acute financial stress and the Fed was on hold at 5.5% for a little bit over a year, right? So we weren't able to crack 3% inflation for a very long time. We're now back over 3% inflation, but it seems that the new norm was, right, like 2.5, 2.4 was the lowest we were able to go without risking immediate financial crisis. So all that is to say, I think 2.5 to 3% inflation is the new norm. I don't think we're ever going to see 2% inflation again. The Fed's reaction time to any sort of slowdown in the economy has been to immediately flood the markets with liquidity. So I think CPI, where it is right now, is the new norm. And the Fed is cutting for employment rather than inflation. It's just the unfortunate reality that elevated inflation is the new norm. Prices are going to go up. The official rate of price inflation is going to be 2.5 to 3% per year. You and I both know it's much higher than that in reality. And it's just, you know, it's a sign of the times. The labor market is weakening. That's why the Fed is cutting. If anything, I think we should be cutting faster, but I've repeated myself one too many times. That's my outlook on the economy as it stands now and where we are in the cycle. I think the Fed needs to be more aggressive, but that remains to be seen. We'll see.
Yeah. And I mean, I think a lot of Bitcoiners would like to see that. And I think honestly, if we were to cut 50 basis points here in the next couple of days, we might see a market rally just because I feel the market has priced in the three cuts already for this year. At least that's been the narrative. And if we cut a little bit more, I think that would be a surprise and we'd see a jolt up. But you already mentioned a little bit earlier about what you guys do over Horizon, kind of unlocking that, home equity towards Bitcoin. Why would you ever hold generational wealth on a piece of paper? It doesn't make sense. You need a foolproof solution, and I've got it for you. You could get this as low as $25, and if you use promo code GreenCandle, you could get 10% off. Being around for 12 years, they've engineered the perfect and most easy to use solution. I've partnered with CryptoSteel to offer for you guys just that. It is the cheapest and most secure way to store your seed phrase. I don't know about you guys, but I don't have too many things where I think one ton is going to fall on this, but it could survive all of that and more. So go to CryptoSteel.com. You can use promo code GreenCandle. You can get 10% off your entire order if you go there today. So go ahead and protect your generational wealth and do it with CryptoSteel. All right, enough from me. Back to the show. That would be a surprise and we'd see a jolt up. But you already mentioned a little bit earlier about what you guys do over Horizon, kind of unlocking that, home equity towards Bitcoin. And I want to hear about the developments that you guys have been, implementing there and how that's going for you guys. Because, from my perspective, it seems like a lot of homeowners are still, I guess, tentative towards Bitcoin. Homeownership was the American dream, and at least it was for quite some time. And I feel like there's still, as much as we get in the Bitcoin ecosystem, that there's still our echo chamber, that we're still very early. So how is the developments at Horizon going and the response to your guys' products? Because it makes a lot of sense, but are people jumping at it as quickly as you would initially think?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. So I'll actually pull up the website here and I can show you a little bit about how it works because this is really cool. And I think the viewers will get a lot of value out of this. So I'll go ahead and share my screen here. But we've been very successful over the last couple of months. I'll go to the webpage first. This is our homepage. What we've seen is that, and this kind of plays into the problem that I was talking about earlier, U.S. home equity sits at an all-time high, but U.S. home growth is below 2%, which is well below the rate of reported inflation. And basically, when they flooded the system with money back in 2020, a lot of it made its way into housing. And so housing has become sort of this de facto savings account. It's become a savings vehicle when nobody asked for it to become a savings vehicle. It's the largest asset in most people's portfolios. It's the most important asset, but not in a monetary sense. And nobody asked for it to become a savings account. Nobody asked for it to be their largest investment, the largest thing in their portfolio. And yet here we are, right? In 2025, when most homes within a reasonable distance to a major American city are $1 million or more, right? A lot of people will cite the median home price statistic of, the median home price is actually $480,000. But what they fail to tell you is that obviously that's factoring in the enormous amount of homes that are in the middle of nowhere. And they're trying to sell young families on this idea that they'll be able to find a home for less than $500,000. But then you look into that and you'll be 2.5 hours away from the major airports and the major cities where people work. And so it's not a viable way to live. So the reality is that homes have never been more expensive. Existing homeowners are sitting on more equity than ever. And Horizon, like, we just offer a really simple way for homeowners to take their equity and put it into Bitcoin, all without monthly payments, without any term limits, no income requirements, and you could retain homeownership. And we've facilitated several transactions for homes that are $6 million in size, $7 million in size, like massive homes. And we've also helped folks who have homes that are 300K, 400K. And so basically everybody all across the spectrum, we've been able to help in one form or another. And the process is actually really quick. So for larger homes, the process is typically 3 to 4 weeks. For smaller homes, and this is all based on when people can get an appraisal and the amount of paperwork that's required, just 2 to 3 weeks. And so this is a hugely transformative thing for many homeowners, because whether you're cash poor and you just don't have money to invest in something like Bitcoin or another high growth asset, or you have money, but you understand the concept of intelligent leverage and you see your home is doing sub 3%, you see Bitcoin rallying over here, and even though you may have the cash to buy Bitcoin, it makes a lot of sense to swap out of your equity and put it into Bitcoin. Basically, like we've seen everybody across the spectrum and we've been able to service all of them. And this is what the website looks like. So you can adjust your home value here on the front. This is our more basic calculator. Let's say we've got a home that's worth $1 million and we've got $1 million, got a mortgage of 150 grand. We'll throw in a example address here. This is the one that I've been using. For basically everything. You throw in your address, it automatically pulls up who you are. And then you can type in your email here. I'm not going to type in my email live just so people don't email me. But then if you go to the calculator here, I'll just type in the exact same address again. Then we can see how much Bitcoin we could unlock assuming those values. Had I gone through the process, those values would have carried over. But let's assume, again, $1 million home, $150,000 mortgage balance. You can swap about 150 grand from your house into Bitcoin in less than 2 weeks. And the best part is that the Bitcoin is entirely the homeowner's to keep. We don't custody it. You can custody it however you want. And we have no claim on it at the very end of the process. So we don't want any of the Bitcoin upside. The Bitcoin upside goes entirely to the homeowner. And this is a revolutionary wealth building tool, right? Ultimately, we've never thought of our homes as investment vehicles. And if you do want to deploy your equity into something like Bitcoin, it has always come with monthly payments and interest charges and term limits and yearly maintenance fees. And it counts as debt against your property. Horizon is none of those things. And so really we're changing the game as far as wealth building is concerned. We've had an extremely successful 6 months since we've launched and we're just so stoked about it.
How does it work with no payments? That's the crazy part to me. That's like blowing my mind. I got that question. And then, all right, if you've got multiple properties, say like instead of if you've got a real estate investor and they wanted to unlock multiple, would you be able to do like, or do you guys do like portfolio loans and stuff like that as well?
Yeah. So we're only doing primary and secondary residences for now, but we are working on rental properties. That's the single biggest question we've got is when are you guys going to have rental property support? Because a lot of folks want to do this in their primary residence. And then they turn around and say, I want to do this on my four rental properties too. We don't have support for that yet, but we're working on it. And then also we're working on commercial properties. That's probably way further down the line because the underwriting for commercial properties is so varied. It'd be much more difficult for us to get that up and running, but rental properties are ideally on the way very soon. And then as far as the no monthly payments goes, basically the way that this works is we have a financing provider that is not interested in Bitcoin whatsoever. What they are interested in is getting long-term exposure to home prices. What they want is, you know, in the same way that you and I invest in Bitcoin because we believe its price will be higher 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when we plan on selling it, this home equity investor, if you will, on the other side of the equation, wants long exposure to residential real estate, homes all across the country, because they believe that the prices will be higher 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now. And so they're willing to forego monthly payments and just get a slice of the home's future value today for a certain amount of money. It's quite innovative. And so it's a tool that fits really neatly into people's lives, right? Because if you think about it, if you take out a HELOC, and let's say you took out a HELOC to draw this exact same amount of Bitcoin, $151,291, with current average HELOC rates of 8.5%, you're going to be paying well over $1,000 a month just to access that capital and buy that Bitcoin. And you're going to be paying, you know, $1,100, $1,200 a month for the entire duration that you hold that Bitcoin until you sell the property or you pay down the HELOC balance, right? And so it's not a very great proposition because basically what you're doing is you're adding a second mortgage. And most people can't afford to do that. Or even if you can, you don't necessarily want to. With Horizon, the way that this works is because there are no monthly payments, because the home equity investor is willing to forego those, you don't have to worry about adjusting your lifestyle at all. You can really just take part in Horizon, buy the Bitcoin, set it and forget it. And it really is that simple. And you can do whatever term limit you'd like. And so if we push this out to 15 years, this is assuming 3% growth rate on the home, 25% growth rate on the Bitcoin. The numbers can get quite crazy. Obviously, these are all projections. This is all illustrated. This is not financial advice. But we've helped dozens of homeowners to this point facilitate this transaction. We have great reviews from all of them. And it's a really, really exciting time because you have a bunch of different companies that help you get a Bitcoin-backed loan, help you acquire dollars using your Bitcoin as collateral. we're helping you acquire more Bitcoin using your house as collateral, right? Without the risk of like a margin call, for example, without the risk of home foreclosure. Those are the primary risks that people are worried about when they hear about a product like this. A lot of folks will quote tweet us and they'll say like, oh my gosh, it's a bubble, sell everything. This is the top, blah, blah, blah. But the reality is like with Horizon, your Bitcoin isn't at risk because we're not holding it as collateral. So if Bitcoin drops 99%, we're not going to foreclose on you. And the second thing is that if the home drops by 50%, 70%, 80%, or our provider comes in at any time, you know, we can't kick you out of your home. We can't force you to sell your home. None of those things, right? So all of those risks that people think of when they think of a loan backed by my house, they're not present with Horizon. And yeah, it's a really neat product.
Yeah, that's amazing. So where can people find out more about this and more about you? You've been very generous coming on here, Joe. So I really appreciate it, man. And this is blowing my mind. I might have to be looking into this more here after we get off this call here, to say the very least. But yeah, man, where can they find out more about Horizon and more about you?
For sure. Well, Brandon, you've been very generous with letting me use the last 10, 15 minutes as a plug for Horizon. So I appreciate that. But it was great chatting with you, man. Thank you for giving me the mic. If you guys want to see more of what I'm doing and learn more about Horizon, you can just go to Joe Consorti. Search up Joe Consorti if you're watching on Google, not on Google, on YouTube, the exact same way that it's spelled right here. Or find me on X at Joe Consorti. It's where I do most of my tweeting. And to learn more about Horizon, you could go to joinhorizon.com and go from there. You can see your home's Bitcoin potential in 90 seconds and see whether or not we could help you stack some more sats.
That's amazing. I'll put all that in the show notes as well. And Joe, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you guys all for tuning in to another great episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you found some value in this one, please hit that subscribe button and that like button to help send this one to the masses. And I've got a surprise for you guys. I've got two more episodes that you have the chance to watch here. So go ahead and click one of them and I'll see you guys all at the next one.